Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
It mightn't be exactly the Cold War, but an exceptionally bleak period in relations between Russia and the United States of America in recent years presents the backdrop for the forthcoming talks between President Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. An undisclosed venue has been agreed by both sides in principle, but will this fresh intervention by the US president help to stop the bloodshed or simply lead to another missed deadline? Well, I'm joined on the line on this by Professor Scott Lucas, Professor of US and International Politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD. Good morning, Scott.
Very good morning, Colin.
What do you think President Trump is trying to achieve or could hope to achieve through a bilateral summit with Vladimir Putin?
Well, Donald Trump just likes the attention, Colin. I mean, I'm sorry to reduce this serious matter to the personal, but you start off with the fact that Trump likes photo opportunities. He likes to be seen alongside other leaders. We know that he has always wanted to be seen alongside Putin. This was true during his first term. This was always the Kremlin's last card to play if it was under pressure. Back in February, they thought they could get a direct agreement with the United States where they could seize about 20% of Ukraine. They'd get sanctions lifted on Moscow. The rest of Ukraine would be kept weak and demilitarized. They mishandled those direct talks with the United States, which cut out Ukraine and Europe by continuing to attack Ukraine with these deadly strikes on civilians. And they lost Trump's support because of that. They lost that personal investment he had in being seen alongside Putin because he wasn't getting that ceasefire. He wasn't ending the war within 24 hours, as had happened. And so we reached this point this summer where instead of the prospect that Trump would support the Kremlin seizing Ukrainian territory, he was threatening these toughened U.S. sanctions, which are supposed to begin today, on Moscow. And so this was the card they had always held out. They had given him the phone calls with Putin. I think there were six this year, but it was that face-to-face with Putin, which was their last incentive they could offer.
The opportunity for Russia is presumably to be the last voice in his ear, trying to appear as reasonable as possible and reestablish that personal regard, as opposed to being the country that has peeved him over how it's behaved so far.
Yeah, there's two problems with the Kremlin's approach, however, one of their own making. The first is, just as they have done throughout this year, Vladimir Zelensky and European partners, and we're talking about France, we're talking about Italy, Germany, indeed even Ireland, that the leaders have worked together to form tactics to counter this direct Kremlin courting of the United States, maintain European support of Ukraine financially, militarily, politically, but also reach out to the Trump administration to try to get them on board. And they were doing that again yesterday, a whole series of phone calls yesterday. But the second reason why the Kremlin's tactics don't necessarily work is they continue every time it looks like they could get Trump alongside them and flatter him, they ruin it with these attacks with hundreds of drones and missiles each night on civilian areas. And just to give you one example of how they mishandle this, a few weeks ago, the day after they met Ukraine, with these talks that Trump thought could lead to a ceasefire, they just launched several hundred drones and missiles, and they wound up hitting a nursing home amongst one of the targets. The person who told Trump about that was his wife, Melania. And Trump has mentioned that on several occasions. Why aren't they ceasefiring? Why are they hitting these civilians? So I think if Russia really wants to win Trump over, they not only have to get this meeting with Putin, they've got to back off those attacks on Ukraine cities, at least for the near future.
Is it possible that some of those high profile, as you say, aerial attacks would stop and Russia could just continue its incremental gains in Donetsk? Would that be a win for Russia out of this kind of a summit? Or does Vladimir Putin have to balance this with his own domestic audience of not being seen to bow to Donald Trump, because the reason he got involved in Ukraine in the first place was because he said it was a Western threat on his border?
Yeah, far from it being to advise Vladimir Putin or that he would ever listen to me, but I always thought this would be the play, that Russia would ease off on attacking civilian areas and they would maintain the attacks on the front lines. But they've got two problems with that. One is, contrary to a lot of chatter amongst commentators who should know better, Russia is not winning on the front lines. They have taken a gradually advanced in eastern Ukraine in particular, an area called Donetsk, but they have not taken key towns despite attacking them for more than a year. They have been pushed back in another region of Ukraine, the Sumy region, where they tried to occupy a buffer zone. And the second problem is Ukraine's hitting back. Almost on a daily basis, Ukraine is hitting facilities that are necessary to support the Russian military, oil refineries, electronics plants, plants making machine equipment that the Russians need, and indeed military bases. Those attacks are getting more intense, and that type of capability is causing problems for Russia, in addition to one other factor, which is that Russia's economy is stalling. GDP is flatlining, and the government budget deficit has just soared by almost 30% last month.
All right. Well, as you mentioned that, Scott, we're also joined on the line by Danny Hewson, who's head of financial analysis at AJ Bell. Good morning to you, Danny.
Good morning.
You've heard Scott's analysis of where the Russian economy is at. Is it in trouble in the short term, or are these very long-term structural problems that it can deal with in the short term?
In the short term, while it is spending so much on defence, then clearly it is writing its own checks. But for people on the ground, that is becoming increasingly difficult. We've got incredibly high inflation, which have then pushed the central bank there to push up interest rates from 20% just down to 18%, actually. And that, of course, the impact that that is having on people on the ground is pretty dire. Now, he was talking about GDP, and absolutely, we were talking just a year or so ago about the fact that Russia was showing the fastest growth, faster than the United States, than the EU, than the UK. And it was, but that's because it is on a war footing. And if you think about how much it's spending on things like tanks, that's well and good. But if those tanks are then destroyed, where is the value?
And where is, on the street, where is this showing? Is it showing in the price of goods? Is it showing in what particular pinch points is this being seen by ordinary people within Russia? Or are they largely being shielded from it?
Look, we know that unemployment is incredibly low, and that means that wages are incredibly high. But because of sanctions, the cost of goods being imported into Russia have gone through the roof. Obviously, stuff that is made in Russia, they're able to keep a bit of a hold on the price of that. But people have been trading down, and a lot of the industries that Russia built up after the Cold War, and that was a really difficult period for Russia, trying to go from, a country that was focused on military to a country that was focused on just a civilian population and, those kind of businesses, that created a recession. And that is something which Vladimir Putin is going to be keenly aware of, because if this war ends, then Russia has to go from a war footing to a peace footing. And a lot of the industries, like the car industry, have been absolutely decimated. It's been unable to import the kind of tech that it needs. And in addition, as you were just hearing, it's now got a massive budget deficit. Its oil and gas reserves, which have helped it fund this war economy, well, the oil price has come down considerably over the last couple of years. It was slated to account oil for 22% of the total revenue this year, but it's fallen by 27% in July. That's down to lower prices and a strong ruble, because the ruble's been a really strong currency, the strongest in global currencies this year, which sort of demonstrates the weird dichotomy of what is going on at the moment for Russia. So a strong ruble, because the central bank interest rate is high, might seem like a good thing. But of course, that means for a lot of people, particularly companies maybe wanting to, kickstart some other part of their business, borrowing is really, really costly.
Before I go back to Scott then, Danny, just finally, how vulnerable is Russia to secondary sanctions? How might this affect Vladimir Putin's thinking?
Yeah, so we know that India has been buying about 35% of its oil from Russia. Russia has had to find other customers to buy its oil, to buy its gas. We know that it has had a number of tankers with obscured ownership, shall we say, which have helped it circumnavigate some of the sanctions. But in terms of those big sales, it needs those countries to keep buying its oil. If India looks at that additional 25% tariff, which has been placed on it because of buying Russian oil, and decides it's just not worth it, then Russia has to find a new customer for that. And the pool of customers is shrinking. Now, it does beg a question about the oil price for the rest of the world. At the moment, on these talks, which are expected to take place between Trump and Putin, we've actually seen the oil price fall, not least because tariffs are expected to suppress global growth. But, you know, potentially pushing the oil price up, it's a double-edged sword because that could help Russia. But then, of course, if it can't find people to buy the oil, even at that inflated price, then it's going to struggle.
All right. Scott, back to you. We're just getting a couple of lines in from the Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk speaking today after talking to Ukraine's president, saying that a pause in the conflict could be close, not the end. He said maybe a freeze is closer than further away, and striking a hopeful note. I mean, I appreciate I'm putting this to you on the hop here. So where might that have come from? Would Ukraine be making these signals in advance to show that to show Donald Trump that they're amenable to a ceasefire, to ramp up the pressure that would be put on Russia in advance of the summit? But would that be maybe how it should be read?
Well, for months, Ukraine and its European partners, including Poland, have proposed a 30-day ceasefire, a pause in the conflict, and the Kremlin has rejected that. What the Tusk statement is part of the European play with Ukraine to get back to the table after the Trump-Putin meeting, whether that's Europe and Ukraine being involved in talks alongside the Russians at working level, or what Zelensky wants, Ukraine's President Zelensky, which is a meeting with Putin and with Trump. So it's a diplomatic ploy, but I think it also is going to highlight the fact that the Russians are going to reject that. They'll reject the ceasefire yet again because Putin is dedicated to conquering Ukraine. And when they reject the ceasefire yet again, it'll put the ball back in Trump's court with Ukraine and Europe saying, look, you met Putin. They're still not ceasefiring. Now you need to ramp up those secondary sanctions.
Okay, Scott Lucas, Professor of US and International Politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD. And earlier we heard from Danny Hewson, Head of Financial Analysis at AJ Bell. Up next, Maura Fay speaks to young farmers ahead of the Tullamore Show this weekend.
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.